This is Jerry Pippin, and this is our UFO show.
Hi, this is Jerry Pippin inviting you to join me and Nancy Wallace in Albuquerque, New Mexico on Friday, August 10th at the Albuquerque Marriott for the opening of the second annual Wake Up Now conference. From the 10-minute opening guided meditation to the closing event on Sunday, you will be treated to a journey into awareness that you will treasure for the rest of your life. 60 vendor spaces, 12 major speakers, including Bill Murphy, Brooks Agnew, David Weatherly, Lynn Buchanan, Nick Redfern, and Patty Greer in person, plus a screening of her latest film. Check out all the information by entering Wake Up Now Conference in your search engine or go to the banners on our website at jerrypippin.com. This is a benefit for the Pace Setting School of Now. We'll see you in Albuquerque.
Welcome back to our UFO show. I got a little press release sometime back from a major public relations company, and it was about Nick Redfern, and we always like to have Nick on anyway, but this press release really got my attention. It made my clock tick, as they say. And basically, it said, Nick Redfern exposes Pentagon secrets, classified files about pyramids, lost civilizations, and UFOs. Now, I mean, if that doesn't get your interest, I don't know what will. And so we thought we would get Nick Redfern on the air here and talk to him about the book. And I believe, Nick, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Jerry.
And I believe the name, I need to give the real name of the book. It's called The Pyramids and the Pentagon. And then there's a subtitle like The Government Top Secret Pursuit of Mystical Relics, Ancient Astronauts, and Lost Civilizations. Is that, did I pretty much get it?
Yep, that's perfect, yep.
You're the most prolific guy I know. You're always writing.
Well,
coming
you
up
know,
with interesting subjects.
I like to write, and I always, you know, I try and always come up with new data and ideas. You know, I don't like to just go over old ground or whatever. You know, I like to try and pursue a new angle, and that's what, you know, I hope I've done with this book. You know, I mean, the ancient astronauts thing has been obviously covered, you know, from the days of Chariots of the Gods through Zachariah Sitchin and, you know, TV shows like Ancient Aliens. And but there was one area that really had never been addressed before to any great extent, and that wasn't, you know, just the ancient astronauts scenario per se, you know, of aliens visiting in the distant past, but it was what government agencies know about that subject. And nobody really delved into that to a great extent. And I had a lot of snippets of stories, such as things like CIA files on Noah's Ark and the Pentagon's research into the pyramids and how they were built. And they were just snippets. So I began sort of digging into it further and then realized that, you know, there was actually a huge story here of how the government was sort of digging into the mysteries of the past as much as they were, you know, UFOs of the of the present, if you like.
Yeah, you know, I had not thought about this so much until we decided to have you on the show, which you're always welcome to be on. But as recently as last week, we had a soundbite with a member of the CIA, and he was talking about looking at lost civilizations and relics and things like that. So evidently, that's piqued our government's interest for some time.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where people say, well, why on earth would government agencies be interested in the pyramids, you know, or things like this? And I think it's clear from reading the files. I mean, one of the things I do in the book is actually use the Freedom of Information Act. We've got quite a lot of files and, you know, previously unseen documentation on this whole issue. And it's pretty clear that one of the things they were looking at, for example, with the pyramids was whether or not they could have been built with, like, levitation or anti-gravity. And so the idea was to look into this, not to really sort of answer historical and archaeological questions about the pyramids, but if they were built with anti-gravity to try and determine how it was done, and if that sort of ancient lost technology could be found and rediscovered and then weaponized in the modern era. So in other words, the whole issue of looking into these tremendous ancient technologies, if you like, was to try and, you know, utilize it for the military today rather than uncover and solve archaeological mysteries, if you like.
Yeah, you talk about the pyramids, and of course it's all kind of mystical to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But evidently, there are many people in high places and high seats of government, not only here in the U.S., but other places, that have been interested in that technology you're talking about.
Yeah, you're right.
We all remember the Cecil DeMille movie where they had all the slaves moving the rocks on them. But it probably didn't happen that way.
No, I mean, what's interesting is that all cultures around the world, whether it's in Egypt, South America, Central America, England with Stonehenge, they all have legends and rumors attached to them, or folklore if you like, that the stones were sort of magically risen into the air. You know, they were sort of by magic means, they were just lifted up, you know, like a just something floating into the sky, if you like a balloon. And, you know, there's no real way to explain that beyond some sort of anti-gravity or levitation process. Now, if it was just in one part of the world, you know, you could write it off as a myth. But when you have the ancient Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, the British, South America, Central America, all having these stories and being separated by thousands of miles, you know, and in many cases never even met each other, and you find that, you know, in each of these cultures, they're talking about multi-ton stones. You know, I mean, some of these stones weigh 50, 100 tons. I mean, the biggest stone at Baalbek in the Middle East weighs in at just around about 1,000 tons. You know, that we could not move that, you know, and airlift that today, never mind thousands of years ago. And what's interesting is that one of the early researchers in this field, who actually came a long way before even Eric von Daniken, was a man named Maurice Jessop, who wrote a book in the 50s called The Case for the UFO. And he actually traveled out to sort of Central and South America and came away pretty much convinced that many of these sort of ancient structures were built with the benefit of like anti-gravity or levitation. And what was interesting is that the Navy actually invited him out to Washington, D.C. to discuss all his theories and ideas. And this, the people who interviewed him were actually from like a special advanced weapons department. So this clearly demonstrates as far back as the 50s, you know, there was this interest on the part of the government in determining if, you know, the ancients had developed some sort of technology, which for whatever reason, we don't really know, got lost, you know, or relegated to folklore. And today we just, most people think it's just nonsense, but the government clearly didn't, you know, because they took a great deal of interest and began following a lot of the authors who were writing about this and talking about it.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't have anybody in the government admitting it, but there seems to have been, and it's still going on, lots of experiments of cloaking devices, moving things up and down runways and riverways and into ports and all of that kind of stuff. You wonder if maybe there was some civilization back there that, had this anti-gravity down pat already. I mean, how else could you build those pyramids? And then you got pyramids down in South America.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things is, and this sounds kind of weird to start with, but all these legends around the world and folklore, they all say that these stones, when they say they were magically lifted into the air, they actually say it was all to, like, tunes and to music and to the, you know, to the tunes of musical instruments and things like that. Now, that sounds weird when you say it like that, but what they're actually saying is that the stones were lifted into the air via acoustics. Now, what's interesting is the military today is actually examining what's called acoustic levitation. And basically the idea, you can describe it in not too technical terms. It's where you have two what are called opposing sound frequencies and within interfering sound waves. And what it does, it creates what's called a resonance zone where you can manipulate and lift objects within that resonance zone via the use of directed acoustic sound waves. Now, the military is actually researching this and has actually even lifted small objects in these acoustic sound waves, if you like. So in other words, you know, our military is researching levitation using sound. And the stories about the pyramids and the South American pyramids and even Stonehenge is that they were built to the sound of magical music, which actually sounds like a folkloric distortion of advanced acoustic technology. So, you know, the mere fact that the military is looking into it suggests that they may have well have got some of their sort of directions and pointers from this ancient technology. But, of course, the big question is, you know, if that was how all these ancient structures were built, were they built by visiting aliens that had this technology, or was it some ancient race that possessed it, you know, like a terrestrial race, a human race, that, you know, either got destroyed or destroyed itself, and then the technology was lost and just relegated to mythology, you know.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject. I think many, many people are always interested in...
Well, I think the pyramids fascinate everybody, you know, because they're just so huge and they just provoke so many questions about how they were built and moved, etc.
When we talk about mystical relics, I think of the Ark of the Covenant. Did you write anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Ark of the Covenant is sort of a very interesting story. I mean, certainly in fiction at least, you know, it was really sort of thrust into the public domain in 1981 with the Indiana Jones film, The Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, which talked about the Nazis actually trying to get their hands on the Ark of the Covenant because, you know, it supposedly had all these mystical, magical powers, etc. And that's actually true. You know, the Nazis did have an entire wing, if you like, where their entire job was to sort of pretty much, you know, run around the world and track down these various mystical relics that Adolf Hitler believed possessed, you know, supernatural powers that could be used against the Allies, etc. But in reality, there is sort of like a parallel to this, and it relates to the CIA, who actually took an interest in the Ark of the Covenant, which isn't actually surprising because, you know, there are stories about it supposedly having the ability to part waters and, again, sort of bring down stone walls, which, again, might be an examination of like something like acoustic technology. You know, maybe it isn't just can be utilized to build things and move things. Maybe, you know, these acoustic directed energies could bring down structures. Now, of course, you know, that sort of provokes the imagery, you know, of the walls of Jericho being brought down to the sound of trumpets. You know, maybe, again, that's an acoustic technology. But the Ark of the Covenant, you know, was supposedly, you know, possessed of these various advanced powers and technologies that, you know, if you got too close to it, you could be killed, which... This has sort of given rise to the idea, you know, was it some sort of electric powered thing that, you know, if you weren't grounded and you walked towards it, you know, you would get a shock, etc. So it sounds like an ancient machine like a highly advanced ancient machine when you listen to the stories. And what's interesting is that the CIA, certainly in the 1960s, had a deep interest in the Ark of the Covenant. And one of the people who was heavily interested in the Ark of the Covenant was Edgar Cayce, the prophet and seer. And his headquarters was in Virginia, or still is, in Virginia Beach. And we know now that several CIA personnel actually infiltrated Casey's headquarters, basically to sort of find out all what he knew about these sort of mysteries of the past. So, you know, clearly people were looking at the Ark of the Covenant as not some sort of mystical thing from God, but like a highly advanced machine of some sort, and, you know, then the race was on to try and find it, if you like.
Yeah, you know, I've always been interested in that, and and you mentioned the sound waves and the sonic.
Yeah.
I always suspected that perhaps that was something connected to the Ark of the Covenant, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and I've heard other people say, well, it was actually a weather machine.
Well, I mean, whatever sort of, people talked about the weather angle, you know, all the acoustic angle, the sort of, almost as if it had possessed qualities that allowed people to sort of manipulate gravity in terms of moving and parting water, that sort of thing. You know, so whatever it was, it seems to have been a highly advanced device with different properties and, you know, that could achieve different things. And so, you know, it's no wonder, I guess, that, you know, people were on the hunt for it. And of course, that intriguing thing that, you know, God supposedly warned people not to get too close to it. And when people did, you know, it was almost like they dropped down dead, you know, as if they literally had an electric shock. And, excuse me.
And if we talk about maybe the Ark of the Covenant was ancient astronaut origins, there may be more than one of them out there.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, if regardless of whether it's ancient astronauts or highly advanced ancient civilizations from here or a combination of the two, you know, I think there's enough evidence and data. Granted, a lot of it is, you know, sort of oral data and written in books, etc., but to suggest that some of these ancient artifacts did survive, you know, and that maybe some of them are hidden by government, but maybe others are hidden by, you know, religious bodies and things like that that don't really know what to do with them because they fear how it might impact upon religion if they're shown to be ancient machines or something. So I think governments recognize that there probably are places around the world where some of this sort of deep data that would really change whole entire aspects of history, you know, is probably stored away somewhere, just, you know, waiting to be uncovered, if you like.
Yeah, Nick Redfern, we're talking with, and we're talking about his latest book, and we'll get more into details and go to the title again here in a minute. But, Nick, we're talking about the Ark of the Covenant. What's your gut feeling about that? Do you think somebody knows where at least one of these things are or is?
Well, yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about the Ark is that, you know, there are a lot of stories about it having been moved and moved again and moved again, you know, as if there were people who are the ones who are guarding it realized that other people were looking for it. Now, certainly the CIA was on the hunt for it. Now, I don't think, I've seen no evidence that the CIA found it or them. You know, it's like, who's to say that, you know, you're quite right. There could be numerous arcs that, you know, one person thinks they've got the arc and somebody else thinks they've got
it's
the arc.
It's kind of like a dog chasing a car. What are they going to do with it when they find it?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think more than anything else, though, that, you know, when you analyze it in black and white fashion, there's no doubt that it sounds like some sort of highly advanced ancient machine rather than some sort of magical wooden box that talked or whatever, you know. It actually sounds like some sort of advanced technology. And I think maybe, you know, it's sort of borderline as to whether or not they'd even recognize it when they found it because it's so steeped in mythology that it's this sort of this small ark, if you like, this small box, you know, not very big at all, but who's to say, you know, what it actually really looked like. And so, and of course, there's probably a lot at stake as to, you know, certain people who want it remaining hidden and other people who, you know, would sort of kill to get their hands on the technology. So,
what other mystical relics fascinated you when you were doing the research for this book?
Well, I think certainly one of the most intriguing of all was the CIA's and the Pentagon's search for the remains of Noah's Ark, which, you know, is a very different sort of ark. You know, the Ark of the Covenant is this sort of small box. Noah's Ark, of course, is this sort of huge ship, which, according to the biblical legends, you know.
And I've known several people looking for Noah's Ark, Mount Arafat, and some people say they found it, some people haven't.
Yeah, that's
what,
right. You know, the biblical story is that Noah's Ark landed on Mount Ararat after the flood, and, you know, it had sort of two of each animals on board, et cetera, et cetera. But you can find flood legends in pretty much every culture around the world, and they don't all talk about Noah, you know, and the ship landing on Mount Ararat, but they all talk about, you know, the gods coming down and telling or helping people to build these giant arks, which were then filled with animals, you know, and that certain areas. I mean, India has its own flood legend. Other areas in the Middle East have theirs. Even Native American Indians, there's a legend of how the gods told them to build these huge canoes to save all the animals. You know, so every culture has this. So there probably were massive floods in times past and that, you know, certain people survived them. But the story of Noah's Ark as it relates to the Pentagon, what happened was that in 1949, the U.S. military mission was flying towards the border of the Soviet Union, where the Russians were building a new missile base. And they had to fly right near Mount Ararat to get to the border area where this base was being built, and they were going to get photographs of it. And as they approached Mount Ararat and flew near the peak, one of the guys on board said he could see this huge wing-like structure, which was about 300 feet long, sticking out of the ice. And the top of Mount Ararat is sort of frozen, you know, with ice and snow all year round. And one of the other guys said he could see a similar wing-like structure of a similar length on the opposing face. And so they, you know, they quickly swung round and photographed all this as well. And of course, you know, if they were wings, you've got an overall wingspan of 600 feet. You know, nobody was flying aircraft, you know, with 600 feet wingspans in 1949. But what's intriguing is that they didn't look like a boat. You know, they didn't look like an old ark or ship. They literally looked like massive wings. So the pictures were taken, and the guys carried on with the original mission, flew back to base, explained what had happened, and all the pictures went to the Pentagon. They were shared with the CIA and vanished for years, although a few of them have now been declassified through the Freedom of Information Act, but not many of them. Now, officially, the Pentagon never called whatever this thing was on Mount Ararat Noah's Ark. They refer to it as the Ararat Anomaly, and that's what they still call it today, and that's what the files are titled, the Ararat Anomaly. And again, I used the Freedom of Information Act to get files on this, and got about 70 pages from the CIA, which talked about, you know, their research into it, and how they'd even sent agents out to sit in the audience at lectures where authors who'd written books about Noah's Ark were giving lectures, and the CIA sat in the audience and listened, you know. So it clearly demonstrates how they were interested in the story of Noah's Ark. But again, it's like, why on earth would the CIA be interested in a story of an old boat? You know, if it is just an old boat, then the CIA would have no interest. But one of the theories that was addressed and researched, and again, they even followed authors who were pursuing this angle, was the idea that what if Noah's Ark wasn't just a huge old ship, you know, with 2x2 animals on board or whatever? What if it was actually an alien ark, like a huge fleet of an armada, if you like, of arks in the sky that came to the Earth when aliens realized that, you know, there was this going to be this massive cataclysm on Earth, which is going to result in floods and tidal waves and, you know, earthquakes, etc., all across the planet. And it was going to, you know, shake up the entire planet for possibly even centuries, you know, where it'd have to rebuild again. And if they could see that coming, you know, the CIA looked at the idea, well, what if they sent down these huge arcs and, you know, took examples of human life, animal life, etc., in the event that the catastrophe was so big that, you know, it would involve sort of the reseeding of the planet again. And what's interesting is that although in the Bible story of Noah's Ark, you know, they talk about Noah taking on two each of the animals, you know, male and female, in a lot of the other legends, they don't talk about animals being taken on board. They talk about the seed of the animal or the essence of the animal being taken on board. And this actually gave rise to discussion in the Pentagon. Could it actually have been animal DNA that were taken on board? You know, the seed or the essence kind of doesn't sound like the complete animal. So the idea is, could it be that these vast arcs, these alien arcs, were like a huge databanks filled with animal DNA, you know, to reseed the planet if the floods were sort of really catastrophic? So, again, I think the reason for the search for Noah's Ark was simply because they were looking to see if there was advanced technology involved that, again, could be utilized.
Yeah, you bring up that subject about maybe this was extraterrestrial in origin. Mm-hmm. And that brings me to the subject of ancient astronauts. And we were talking about religion here.
Yeah.
It seems to me that not only just the Christian religion, but quite a few religions have been a big roadblock to us accepting the idea that perhaps there's something to the ancient astronaut hypothesis. In other words, we're all star seeds.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this is, you know, I think this is one of the reasons why there's been so much secrecy around this, because, you know, religion is a very emotive topic, whichever side of the fence you're on. You know, if you're a believer an agnostic or an atheist. It's still a big issue. You know, people debate it. And, you know, a lot of people don't want their belief systems questioned. And when you're talking not just thousands or even millions of people, but billions of people, you know, who believe in this religion or that religion, you know, to suggest that maybe some of these accounts of the gods coming down, you know, in flaming chariots were actually aliens coming down in UFOs, it would be very difficult, I think, for government agencies to go public and say that, you know, on the nightly news where the president stands up and says, you know, all these ancient beliefs you have, it's all, it's nonsense, you know, it's just that they're actually the equivalent of our NASA astronauts. You know, all hell would break loose. You know, there'd just be chaos would just erupt everywhere.
Yeah, if a high government official like a president or somebody like that came out and said, yeah, we have proof of, you know, that there's alien intervention here. Yeah. Now that everybody would be up in arms. That, I mean, he'd be committing political suicide.
Well, that's one of the things why, one of the reasons I don't think the story is coming out is because the implications of what would happen afterwards, you know, not just as far as the public's concerned, but whoever, whichever party was in power, you know, they probably, the other one would have such a great tool. They could, you know, let's say the Democrats announced it. The Republicans would just say, you know, that this president's trying to destroy your God. Never
yeah,
elect the Democrats
again.
It'd be
those atheistic liberals.
Yeah, exactly. And then if it was the other way around, you know, the other one would be doing it as well. And I think it's that's one of the reasons. Nobody, whatever, even if that story is true, you know, we don't know if it is true, but if the government suspects it is, I think part of the secrecy is purely and simply because nobody, even in government, knows how to tell the story without it creating just worldwide havoc, if you like.
What do you make of ancient astronauts? What kind of proof did you come across for the book?
Well, I mean, in fairness...
Or was it all supposition?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I point out in the book, that, you know, even though we're dealing with governments and secrecy, you know, at the end of the day, they're just like us. They're looking into a mystery and trying to solve it. And, you know, of course, if you're dealing with a UFO sighting from 24 hours ago, or even right now, you know, the military can scramble aircraft or check radar, etc. What they were doing with these ancient mysteries is very different because, you know, they were sort of looking into the mysteries of the past, things from thousands of years ago. Now, granted, you know, they had things like spy satellites and aircraft that could fly over Mount Ararat and photograph this so-called Ararat anomaly, you know, and they launched clandestine missions to, you know, investigate the pyramids and stuff like that. So they clearly had a bigger budget that allowed them to do things. But, you know, even when you're with all that, if you're digging into a mystery that occurred 5,000 years ago, you know, you're going to be limited, I think, in what you can find, unless you actually stumble upon the thing. You know, it's like you could investigate the Ark of the Covenant, but you're only going to be able to take it so far unless you actually find the Ark of the Covenant. So I think that's why within government, you know, there were as many people who believed that what was found on Mount Ararat was Noah's Ark, as there were as many people who believed it was a UFO or something, some sort of advanced technology. So even in government, there was no real consensus because some people were driven by a religious belief and others were driven by like a UFO belief, kind of like us on the outside. You know, that's a big irony. They weren't thinking that different to those of us, you know, on the outside, you know. So.
Yeah. You know, another thing you wrote about in this book that always fascinates me is and just the term lost civilizations gets your mind spinning.
Yeah.
But I wonder why these civilizations became lost.
Well, you know, I mean, the one thing that all ancient religions and civilizations, you know, have in common when it comes to these stories about fantastic civilizations and beings, etc., is that they all seem to have come to a sudden end. You know, whether they blew themselves up, obliterated themselves, or wiped out by some plague, you know, or there was a planetary disaster, you know, like a meteorite hitting the planet or a flood, you know, that they all sort of, all these legends have one thing in common, and that's what it is. It's like these civilizations rose, they achieved fantastic things, and then they were gone. Now, one of the things I talk about in the book that relates to this issue of lost civilizations relates to none other than Dr. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb. Oppenheimer, you know, he was, you know, without Oppenheimer, there wouldn't have been an atomic bomb, you know, and probably the Second World War wouldn't have ended as quickly as it did, you know, when the bombs were dropped on Japan. But Oppenheimer, as well as, you know, having a deep interest in atomic research, et cetera, and developing the bomb, he also had a more than an interest, but probably what you would call an obsession, with an ancient Indian text, the Mahabharata, which basically, I mean, how old this is, nobody really knows. You know, some estimates suggest 8,000 years old. Other people have suggested that it's actually based on an even older documents, possibly, you know, going back tens and tens and tens of thousands of years. And it basically tells of like a localized war in India between two rival factions. But, you know, you'd imagine that for that sort of era, it would be talking about, you know, fighting with chariots and bows and arrows and spears and shields and that sort of thing. But it actually doesn't. It talks about the battle being fought with these flying vehicles known as Vimanas, which, when you read the description of them, they sound like some sort of, you know, jet-powered fighter plane or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they fired, reportedly, these, you know, sort of these powerful iron rods that at the, you know, the opposing cities. And when they did that, you know, it would result in this huge pillar of flame and smoke go up into the sky, which would hang there for days. You know, it sounds like an atomic mushroom cloud. And more intriguing, the soldiers would start to fall sick and die in the days afterwards, not, you know, immediately from the blast. And this kind of sounds like radiation poisoning. It even talks about, you know, the soldiers, the nails falling out and things like that, and jumping into rivers to try and wash themselves, which sounds like a, you know, an emergency attempt to decontaminate yourself against, you know, radiation poisoning. And when you put all these different pieces together, you know, these iron rods, you know, firing these brilliant explosions and blowing up cities and this huge plume of smoke hanging in the air ominously for days and soldiers getting sick. When you put all that together, it sounds like an ancient nuclear war. And the fact that none other than the father of the atomic bomb, Robert Oppenheimer, was obsessed by it, you know, makes you wonder if he knew some parts of government secrets, you know, about, hey, you know, we found that we weren't the first ones to develop atomic energy. And more intriguingly, in 1952, at a conference in D.C., Oppenheimer was asked, you know, were the atomic bombs that, you know, we detonated, the first test one in New Mexico in 45, and then the two dropped on Japan. He was asked, you know, were they the first atomic examples of atomic bombs having been developed? And Oppenheimer said, yes, and then he paused for a second, and he added, in the modern era, you know, as if to say, well, yeah, we were the first ones to develop them in the modern era, but not in the ancient era, you know. So it's almost as if he was giving a few little hints and secrets that he knew we weren't the first, you know, that maybe somebody came before us and but obliterated themselves. But the Mahabharata doesn't talk about like a worldwide war. It's like a localized one. And I think that makes more sense, you know, that there could have been highly advanced localized civilizations like this one, like the Atlanteans, etc., who vanished completely because it wasn't like a worldwide thing like our civilization today. It was sort of localized in different areas.
When we talk about lost civilizations, everyone thinks of Atlantis, or at least most people.
Yeah.
But evidently, there's been quite a few lost civilizations.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I do. I think, you know, if we look at our world today, you know, we've basically got a worldwide civilization. And although, you know, some countries are highly advanced and others are still living in, you know, sort of jungle huts or whatever, but for the most part, it's like a network of a one civilization, you know, whether it's North America, South America, Europe, Russia, China, the Far East, Middle East, you know, it's a civilization. But what I kind of get from looking at these ancient stories is that there wasn't this huge worldwide civilization that flourished and destroyed itself, but it seems certain parts of the world, you know, the people advanced very quickly or were helped, you know, you could argue by extraterrestrials, like Egypt, you know, in Egypt, when the pyramids were being built, there are other parts of the world where people really were, you know, still in caves or whatever. So I think that might explain why some of these civilizations, there's no trace of them. Because if it was a worldwide thing, we'd find far more evidence. But if it was like a localized small country that got obliterated, you know, that would.
And I guess when we talk about lost civilizations, sometimes there's markers or historical monuments and things that really kind of point to what you're saying.
That's kind of present day evidence. Yeah, and I think the other thing to remember as well, you know, with all these ancient floods stories, then, you know, there's a lot of stories about, you know, possibly some of these ancient civilizations may have actually, what would have been land in their period, you know, is not now the bottom of the Pacific or whatever, you know, and some of these deeper levels in the ocean, we're just, even today, not able to get to. So, you know, who knows if there are ancient structures down there that, you know, when the earth was in turmoil and, you know, there were earthquakes and tidal waves and floods, etc., maybe a lot of this land still exists, but, you know, it's now at the bottom of the ocean, you know, where the land once was or whatever. So.
You know, this is a UFO show, so I got to bring that up for a little bit here. And in your book, you seem to hint that you feel that maybe it's a little more than a hint that UFO evidence has been hinting over the years.
Oh, well, yeah, there's no doubt about
that. And it's pretty obvious as we do UFO shows. Obviously, that's true about present day, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, one of the interesting angles or stories I relate in the book actually relates to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which in a weird way actually has an ancient UFO link to it. We know now, thanks to a man named Miles Copeland, who was a senior CIA operative in the CIA. He, in 1947, was working out of the CIA's office in Damascus, and he went on record as stating that on one day in 1947, the year in which the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, that a guy, like a mysterious Bedouin-type character, came into the embassy, the American embassy where his office was based, and said he had something important he wanted to show to somebody in a position of authority. And it was basically like an ancient scroll, like a Dead Sea Scroll, written in some very ancient and archaic language, which Copeland obviously didn't understand. And it was sent to the CIA for to be deciphered, you know, by code breakers, etc. And supposedly it related to the Book of Daniel, which talks all about weird prophecies and dreams and things like that. And what's interesting is, you know, again, like with Noah's Ark, why would the CIA be interested in analyzing the Dead Sea Scrolls? You know, that would be more the work of historians or archaeologists. But there's another strand to the story, and it relates not to just UFOs, but crashed UFOs. In the 80s and 90s, a number of UFO researchers, including Bill Steinman and Tim Cooper, were both given stories by sort of whistleblower types, if you like, who told them that in a number of UFO crashes in New Mexico in 1947-48, that when the military got there and got inside these craft, they found these weird parchments that look, retrospectively now, like the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, so the idea of finding a crashed UFO is, you know, sort of sensational enough. Finding ancient parchments inside them, you know, takes it to a whole nother level. Now, that in itself is a controversial story, which I admit in the book we're not able to verify. But we can verify the Miles Copeland story that the CIA, in 47 of all years, was researching the Dead Sea Scrolls. So, you know, this sort of opens up another can of worms that links ancient artifacts, relics, etc., with crashed UFOs and alien technology.
Yeah, you're connecting some dots there, and maybe some people says it's a stretch, but other people, including myself, thinks you may be onto something.
Well, you know, I mean, the interesting thing is that regardless of whatever the truth is behind these crashed UFO and, you know, scroll stories, etc., for some reason, in the 80s and 90s, somebody in government wanted to promote the idea that Dead Sea Scroll-type artifacts had been found in crashed saucers in New Mexico in 47. You know, the stories that were leaked out spanned, you know, more than 10 years, and from Bill Steinman in the mid-80s through Tim Cooper in the late 90s. And, you know, so somebody clearly wanted to get this story out. And as I said, you know, people can sort of roll their eyes and say there's nothing to it, except for one intriguing fact that in 47, you know, Roswell was 47, Kenneth Arnold was 47, And the one thing we know for sure, thanks to Miles Copeland and various other people who've come forward, is that in that very year, the CIA was researching the Dead Sea Scrolls out of the Middle East. So, you know, that then doesn't make the other aspect of the story too unbelievable, if you like. So.
Yeah. We're talking with Nick Redfern, and you'll be at the Wake Up Now conference in Albuquerque coming up in August.
Yep.
10 through 12. What are you going to speak about there?
I'll probably speak about this, actually, Jerry, you know, sort of the breaking stories about these ancient artifacts and, you know, what the government knows. Because, you know, it's one of these areas where everybody, I think, knows the general stuff, like Eric Von Daniken and Zechariah Sitchin. Not many people are aware of the government involvement in it. So, you know, I think I'll probably talk about that because it'll, you know, be sort of new and fresh for people.
Over your years of research, you've dug into some pretty interesting stories. What has surprised you most? To me, it seems like it would probably be like what we've been talking about here. The government's interested in all kinds of things
that you wouldn't think they would be. No, I mean, I actually would agree with you on that, Jerry. I mean, everybody knows, you know, regardless what people think UFOs are, everybody knows the government's investigated them, you know, but this actually surprised me was doing the research, was the sheer extent to which governments had investigated ancient artifacts, etc. You know, everything from Dead Sea Scrolls, pyramids, Ark of the Covenant, you know, Atlantis, pyramids and levitation, the Mayan prophecies, Stonehenge. You know, they were literally running around like government equivalents of Indiana Jones, you know, and just trying to find all this stuff.
And you mentioned Mayan prophecies, and we're talking about lost civilizations. It's not lost on me that we're talking about 2012 and all of those rumors. I don't know if civilizations would disappear just like that. Any evidence of how that happens?
Well, not really. I mean, the best we can say about those in the past is that, you know, a lot of them are connected with vast worldwide disasters like floods. You know, I mean, a massive worldwide flood caused by something like a polar tilt, you know, would wipe out entire cultures. There's no doubt about that. You know, even like a 5-foot raise in the water levels would just be disastrous, you know, for whole nations. So, you know, if there's something really cataclysmic occurred across the world, then, you know, that would explain, I think, why a lot of these civilizations would be wiped out. But, I mean, in terms of the 2012 thing, I mean, you know, whatever's going to happen, if anything's going to happen, we haven't got long to wait to find out. But one of the things I would say, you know, a lot of people get really sort of worried about this, but if you look at the original Mayan prophecies, what they said was that December 21st, 2012, basically, it's the end of a cycle. The Mayans believe that the Earth or civilization developed in cycles. And it's that word cycle that's got people puzzled. Does it mean the end of the world or the end of civilization where we have to start over? Or does it just mean like a cultural shift or a mind shift or a spiritual shift? You know, like a beginning of a new era of, you know, how we appreciate things or whatever. You know, the Maya prophecies actually don't say anything about the world ending or, you know, tsunamis or comets hitting the world. They just say it'll be the end of the current era. But that doesn't necessarily mean disaster. It could just mean a new appreciation of the planet or something, you know.
Okay, tell the name of the book again for people.
All right, the Pyramids and the Pentagon, and it's available from all good outlets, whether online, you know, or bookstores as well. So.
And I know of two or three books you've written this year. You must write an average of four or five a year.
I do about two a year. But what sometimes happens is that because I'm with several publishers, what occasionally happens is that, you know, I'll write one and they'll hold on to it for a year or 6 months, and then coincidentally it'll come out at the same time or a couple of months after one of the other publishers. So it looks like I've cranked out three or four in 1 year, when one might have just been sitting in the office, you know, for 12 months, and then they all put them out together, you know. So I probably do about two a year. So.
Yeah. Now, the Wake Up Now conference coming up August 10th through 12th, you'll be there.
You
go other places, too. I've seen you all around. So,
I do a lot of lectures. Actually, I was down talking about this book, actually, in Houston on Sunday yesterday. I just drove back home today, and I'll be in Minneapolis in October, a conference there. So, you know, I like to travel around and get the word out and, you know, sort of hang out with people and have a good time.
Yeah, that conference up in Minneapolis, I believe Von Doniken's going to be there.
That's correct, yeah. So I'm going to be talking about this book there as well, and, you know, it should be a good conference.
Yeah, that'd be very interesting. Nick, you got any closing thoughts? We're almost out of time.
Well, you know, I always say to people, you know, if you're interested in all this stuff, get researching, because you could be the one person who sort of really, you know, blows the lid on all this. A lot of people have been looking into this, you know, for decades and decades. And, you know, when you go looking, you know, as I demonstrated with this book, you can find some weird stuff. And, you know, if you're interested and you want to find the answers, then, you know, you might be the one who finds the real answers or the full answers, you know.
Okay, thanks very much, Nick Redfern. We'll be talking soon.
Thanks,
Jerry. The Wake Up Now conference in Albuquerque in August.
All right, cool.
Hi, this is Jerry Pippin inviting you to join me and Nancy Wallace in Albuquerque, New Mexico on Friday, August 10th at the Albuquerque Marriott for the opening of the second annual Wake Up Now conference. From the 10-minute opening guided meditation to the closing event on Sunday, you will be treated to a journey into awareness that you will treasure for the rest of your life. 60 vendor spaces, 12 major speakers, including Bill Murphy, Brooks Agnew, David Weatherly, Lynn Buchanan, Nick Redfern, and Patty Greer in person, plus a screening of her latest film. Check out all the information by entering Wake Up Now Conference in your search engine or go to the banners on our website at jerrypippin.com. This is a benefit for the Pace Setting School of Now. We'll see you in Albuquerque.